I want to thank you all for coming out to our book club here at the Housing Works in New York. We're talking tonight about Margaret Atwood. Margaret, thank you for coming down from frozen north. No,
no, not frozen anymore, but it's a pleasure.
Thank you. We go way back. We've been talking to each other for decades.
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 Centuries.
Centuries. And a lot of people think that Margaret writes science fiction, but she doesn't. I remember the first time we met, and I made that mistake of calling it science fiction, and you were not shy about correcting me.
You can call it that if you like.
But it's what you call it.
Well, I just don't like category confusions, by which I mean I don't have any spaceships.
No spaceships.
No, I have no galaxy far, far away and in another time, although, of course, I go to all those movies. But I just can't write that. And I also don't have any science fiction fantasy, which is a galaxy far, far away and in another time with dragons.
Oh.
So, unfortunately, although I read that too, I'm not good at it. So best not to do things that you're really not good at. So I feel that I write something more in the genealogy of 1984, Brave New World, going all the way back to Jules Verne, who thought he was writing about things that really were going to happen and were almost happening, such as submarines. Mm-hmm. So I like to write about things that are really almost happening, or indeed are happening, only people don't know it yet.
Uh-huh.
So that's why, unfortunately, there are no people in tight silver clothing on the covers of my books. I would like to have some, but it would be misrepresentation, be false advertising. So that is why I like to say, you know, call it what you like, as long as you're willing to admit that although broccolis and cauliflowers are both closely related, they are not the same thing. Are we clear?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. You call it speculative.
Yeah, so do a lot of other people.
Yeah.
I didn't make it up.
How many of you are reading Oryx and Crake for the first time? Here. Clap if I was like, I can't see you. There you go. How many of you read this book all the way back when it was published in 2004?
Wow.
How many times do you read your own? Do you read your own books later in years?
Well, you have to read your own book quite a lot when you're writing it, and indeed before you publish it. So I do the first draft, then I do the second draft, then I do the third draft, then I do the fourth draft, and then I do the fifth draft, and then I might show it to the publisher. And then I do the sixth draft. And the final draft is done with a copy editor. And that's the really important one. I have a copy editor that I read. I shouldn't have said that. They're all important. Getting intro. Phew. Yes, so she's the one who will say, as she said to me about Oryx and Crake, so you send Jimmy out with 5 Jolt bars. And he eats one here, one here, one here, one here, one here, and one here. So you either have to give him one more to eat, or you have to have him eat one fewer, because my readers, as I know, will count those things. I will hear from them.
That's just
if
who
there
they
is
are.
The wrong number of Jolt bars in the novel.
Do you know where the novel's going to end before you get there?
I have a guess. I have an idea. But I'm always wrong. So I just about am always wrong about that. So I have an ending in my mind, and that's never actually what happens.
Was there an alternative ending to Oryx and Crake that you had?
Well, there was an alternate ending, but it's in volume 2. Yeah, volume 2, which is called The Year of the Flood, ends at the same moment in time that Oryx and Crake ends, but just with a few more minutes added on.
Right.
So you find out what happens right after the end of the first one.
Margaret and I are going to continue to chat for a while, get you thinking about the book, and we want you to be part of our conversation. So start formulating questions in your mind, because we're going to open up the floor to questions at the end, and I'll let you know when we can start lining up the microphone here. Now, let's talk about Crake, because it's amazing. He is so much more real these days. I mean, when we think about...
You mean there could be a Crake?
Yeah.
There could have been a Crake then, too, but CRISPR has made it much more possible.
You anticipated my question, of course.
Yes. CRISPR has made it more possible, but
Tell people what CRISPR is, if they don't
CRISPR
know what
CRISPR is. A super splicer genetic editing tool that makes it, you know, the cut and paste function on your computer? It's sort of like that, only with genes. So it makes it possible to combine life forms a lot more easily than they were doing it back in 2001 when I started writing this book. I also have another character who is involved in this super splicer kind of idea, but that is a graphic novel called Angel Catbird, which is about to be published on September the 6th. And you know how superheroes have to have origin stories.
Right.
So we know where Superman came from.
Right.
We know about Batman and things like that. So, and we know about the Hulk, and we know about the Human Torch. So in the 40s, you would have become the superhero by maybe falling into a vat of chemicals, if it wasn't a magic word such as Shazam.
Being bit by a spider.
That was later. That was the early 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, spider. Radioactive spider. We had got that far. But nowadays, of course, you would become a superhero by colliding with a vial of genetic super splicer. And that is how we get a flying part cat, part bird, part human being.
Mm-hmm. Is Crake modeled on any real world scientist?
Is Crake modeled on any real world
that
scientist knew? That I knew?
Or I should say that you're willing to talk about.
Okay, that I'm willing to talk about. So I did grow up amongst the biologists, and some of them were rather focused.
They were what?
They were focused.
They were focused.
Like, focused.
Yeah, I got you.
I read about one. I didn't know this guy, but I read about a guy who, around the time I was writing Oryx and Crake, had created, out of the raw materials, he had created a polio virus. And someone said to him, "Why did you do that?" Meaning, why did you do something so dangerous? His answer was, "Because it's a really big virus. Next time I'll do something more difficult." I mean, he was focused. He was focused on his own program, let us put it that way. But I think Craig is more focused on the overview of the planet. Mm-hmm. So he sees the way things are going. And of course, there have been various interpretations of Craig. And people, epidemiologists and people who study these things, say that you could start an epidemic that would be really quite destructive. You could do that now. But in order to do that, you would have to be willing to destroy your own side. Mm. You know, some people have not been using that in combat warfare because you can't control it.
That's what happened in the book.
Destroyed. That was his intention. So he's doing, you know how you reboot your computer?
Yeah.
He's doing a reboot of humanity with maybe a few features adjusted because he's made a new and improved model of us with some things I would quite like to have myself.
Yeah. We would all like
that. I'd like the built-in sunblock. I think that would be good. I would like the built-in insect repellent. Gives you sort of a citrus smell. And,
would you like to have grass for dinner also?
Well, it would solve a lot of problems. You'd have to have some adjustments to your digestive system, more along the line of rabbits. But, you know, you wouldn't have to have agriculture. There are a lot of things you wouldn't have to have. So they don't have clothes, so no cotton farming, no fashion industry. They don't have to raise animals and eat them. So that solves the methane problem and the deforestation. They can eat leaves and grass. They don't even have to have vegetable farming. They don't have to have Brussels sprouts. They don't want them.
And they don't have to have emotions either.
They have emotions, but their emotions are more standard for mammals.
General mammals.
Are not interested in sex every day of the year. It would be unlike ourselves. Or we used to be anyway in the 50s. Maybe things have changed.
Not going there.
You're not going there. So these are more like your ordinary mammal, which has a season of being in heat, and then the rest of the time they're not interested. So they don't have what we would call the romantic agony.
Is that because those things get in the way of what he believes?
You mean for mammals?
For the civilization he wants to create.
It solves a lot of problems that are with us today. Think of how many people are crying their eyes out because they got rejected for Friday night or Thursday night or even Wednesday night or 2 months from now.
Right.
So nobody ever gets rejected romantically in the world of the Krakers.
What was the whole point of the world of the Krakers? With that pain?
They won't make our mistakes. So because they're not territorial, they won't have wars. Also, there are very few of them to begin with.
Did you think of Krake as a sort of a messianic figure?
Well, he thinks of himself that way.
Yeah,
you
does.
May not agree with him. You may think that we might solve our problems in a less radical way. And I certainly hope you will think that. This is not my desired model of how we should be spending the next 30 years.
Was it something to scare us? This is the opposite of the model.
I don't think people get radically scared by books of fiction. I think they may ponder. They may think. I don't think they're going to run screaming out into the street. I don't think it's going to have the effect of, for instance, Orson Welles' radio program of War of the Worlds that people really believed was true. So it says right on the front, fiction. That means it's not true.
Well, but his radio broadcast was happening in real time. Your book, somebody's reading about the future or some other kind of society.
Yeah, it purported to be happening in real time. He did say at the beginning, you know, this is a radio, but some people tuned in late, so they thought it was real.
Yeah. He has a sort of, Craig has, he's sort of arrogant, isn't he?
Sort of.
Trying to be nice to your character.
You can be nice to my other character.
How many? Did you find, now you grew up in a family of science, right? Your father?
My father, my brother, my cousins, my nephews, you know. Basically, I was the other person.
You're the one that didn't go that direction.
I didn't, but I could have.
Do you ever think about that? What the path not taken? You're rubbing your hands.
Uh-huh. You know what Flaubert said about Madame Bovary? Madame Bovary, c'est moi. So, Craig, c'est moi. No, it's not. I'm just joking. Just joking. I'm more like...
What are other scientists? Do you get responses from other scientists about the Craig?
Absolutely.
What do they say?
They laugh their heads off. I think it's pretty funny.
Is that a self-conscious laugh? That can't be me.
Partly. But partly, of course, I have to do the research and get it right, or I'm going to hear from my older brother. And this is what I heard from my older brother, who used to go through my books and mark all the typos. But he's an older brother.
Between that and your editor, you have a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Well, they always miss something. But he catches it. So he said about the Krakers. And I have to point out that these Krakers purr like cats in order to self-heal. So my brother said, I thought you did quite a good job with the sex, but I'm not so sure about the purring. However, since that time, 2003, science has vindicated me. Because we've now done the research, and it turns out that putting a purring cat on your head when you have a migraine is quite helpful. They don't tell you how to make it stay there, but sort of a piece of netting or, you know, a special hat.
I didn't realize how much.
Yeah. Wow. Have a look at it.
What a public service you were doing.
Yes, well, this is it. I think of the whole thing as a public service.
How predictive, what do you think in the book, and there are a lot of predictive
how predictive,
things, how predictive are we now? What are we closest to creating that
okay,
you created?
So some people thought that I had made up everything in it. We actually already had the spider goat by 2001. We already had the luminous green rabbits. Those were existed already. We were working on the human kidneys grown in pigs. And apparently we've now made considerable breakthrough. And they used to apparently have a law saying you weren't supposed to put human brain tissue into other animals, but they're considering changing that.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I would say coming along, you know, coming along in that direction. The lab meat, I'm sure you've read about
yes.
that.
Yes.
So I've got lab meat in the third one. In the first one, I've got chicky knobs. And chicky knobs are a sort of plant animal, like a chicken, only it grows more like a plant and it doesn't have a head. No brain, no pain. No animal will suffer in the growing of these multiple thighs, breasts, and wings that the chicky knobs put out. Makes sense.
Yeah. How many of you in the audience, by your applause, think that we're getting close to the characters, the kind of animals we're seeing? And, yeah.
Well, some of them are quite nice. I think.
You mean the people? Oh.
I mean them too.
Yeah.
The combination of skunk and raccoon.
What are the characteristics?
They both have nice things about them. But they also have detrimental things. So skunks are very cute and cuddly, but they smell. So raccoons are very curious and can be quite destructive. They're not as placid as skunks. But if you combine the two and you had an animal that was cute as a skunk but didn't smell, and also cute as a raccoon but not as destructive, I think you'd have something pretty darn cute. Don't you? Wouldn't you like to have one? Sure you would.
Yeah, I think maybe. Yeah. I don't know, like maybe a cross between a cat and a dog somehow would be.
That would be possible too, but why bother? You know, they both are what they are already.
Yeah. Were there things you think you could not improve on? You know, animals that are. How much thought goes into also the names you come up with?
Okay, so names
those
are...
Those names must... How do
yeah,
you, be
names
about
are
them all
interesting
the time. Yeah.
Because people are inventing... We live in an age of huge name invention, and that's partly due to the internet. People have had to invent domain names, they've had to invent company names that nobody else has, and this spurs a lot of name creation. So I had to research every one of the names in that book to make sure there wasn't already one. And in a lot of cases, actually, there was.
Really?
Yeah. So in the book, there's a podcast website type of thing called nightynight.com, which is where you get to stage your own assisted suicide with whatever, sort of nightclub singers and special effects and things. You get to stage it like a dramatic event. But I looked up Nighty Night I researched it, and there was already something called Nighty Night. It was a children's sleepwear company. So I thought, you know, these people are going to be very mad at me. So I had to change the spelling. And that is why there are a lot of odd spellings in the book, because there were real examples of that name only spelled more correctly.
Your vision of the internet at that time, back in 2003 and earlier when you were writing it, is a very dark one. It's a place that still is, but you talk a lot about a place for pornography.
It's no. What? You're telling me that's real?
I hate to break the news to you. And the place for committing suicide.
A lot.
But did you see social communities at all, like Twitter or Facebook or any of those things?
Didn't see those.
Yeah.
They hadn't happened yet. It was still in 2001 when I started. It was websites. There was blogging. I've got some of that in. I've got already people were making videos of themselves, so that's happening. I didn't see the Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. Mm-hmm. Didn't see that.
Very few people did in the future.
Well, if they had, they probably would have invented it first, wouldn't they?
Do you think that if there had been Twitter or Facebook or social communities had been in vogue at the time of this society, that it might have taken a different arc to the story? People might have.
Well, it would depend. I mean, we're now at the moment. We're at the moment right now, when governments are trying to put the lid on a lot of this stuff, and they have done it successfully. For instance, in China, mm-hmm. they do have a digital wall around China. You can't get in there with Facebook or Twitter. They've got their own versions of those things, but they can control them pretty effectively, and we used to think in about maybe 2008 or 9 that the internet was wide open, it was free, it was unsupervised, but we have since found, of course, we were being snooped on the whole time. So our view of it has already gone through several different phases. And I would say we are at the moment when there's a concerted effort being made to control it.
Mm-hmm. Is that the topic of maybe a book?
Not for me. Other people are writing books like that quite a lot. And as you know, there's the visible part of the internet, and then there's the dark web. And I do know some people who study those things. It's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Is there a bit of technology that...
You want to follow what our government's doing. There's an outfit called the Citizen Lab. It's in Toronto, and they particularly study government attempts to control the internet.
Is that a theme of yours? I mean, you seem very concerned about that direction.
Which theme? Government control of things?
Yeah.
I think it's... Gee whiz, really? Do you think I should be concerned about that? Remember
well,
when
I mean, that's the point of your whole book. I mean,
yeah, sure,
is control
yeah,
of everything.
Yeah, but that's corporations rather than governments.
Uh-huh.
In that world, government as such is pretty weak. And corporations have taken over a lot of spaces that used to be government, such as policing. And there are already more private police enterprises in this country than there are public ones.
Like,
just
like
for
prisons
instance.
In this country.
That too, and that's a negative thing in my view.
Because we never hear about the government at all.
Well, because it has been diminished, and corporations. If you look at the earnings of the largest corporations compared to the earnings of most countries, corporations have got a lot more money. I don't like to, you know, discourage you in any way.
Well, you did. I mean, there's a line from your book. I'm going to quote it. Remember when voting mattered?
Yeah,
it's
I
right
know.
Out of...
Isn't that sad? I think it does still matter, by the way. So I'm a great fan of at least being able to vote in some meaningful way. Mm-hmm. But remember how old I am. So I was born in 1939. I went through the age of the huge government dictatorships, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and some minor ones, or smaller ones like Pol Pot, etc. So that is one form of attempting to control everything. Another form of attempting to control everything is much more behind the scenes. And technology has provided a big tool for doing that.
Why is there there's nothing that can control Craig?
Because he's very secretive. People don't know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. And he has kept it that way.
He's
fooled everybody with these pills he gives out.
You got it.
I mean, he promises them all kinds of unlimited sex and just the opposite.
Well, they get unlimited sex, but then they get death.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Oh,
well, what the heck. They go out happy. Yes.
How did you come up with that idea?
Reading about drug companies and the studies that they do on the drugs they make that they do not divulge. Just for instance, there's a book called Bad Pharma by a guy called Ben Goldacre that you might like to have a look at. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not that these things don't exist in the real world, and you could quite easily make a pill that purported to have a certain group of effects, but also had a group of other effects. In fact, that happens all the time. They just don't necessarily divulge those studies. Yeah.
Was there something in particular going on in the world at the time you were writing this that gave you an idea about the direction you'd want to take?
Yeah, I read pop science a lot. I always have, because, as I say, I almost went in that direction. And I'd followed the DNA story all of those years, and parallel to that, I'd followed the extinction story. So the number of species that are going extinct, the amount of habitat destruction, all those kinds of things. And why would we think that our own species is immune from extinction? I also have a little, this may sound macabre to you, but I have a little part of my library consecrated to the Black Death and how people reacted to it, which is pretty interesting too. So epidemics, I think I read as a teenager one of those formative books, which is called Rats, Lice, and History. I'm sure you remember it. Mm-hmm. And then we had Guns, Germs, and Steel. And then we had 1491, which was about what the Americas were like the year before Columbus set foot on it, and actually how many people died. It was way more than with the Black Death. They figure probably 80 to 95%. That's a big epidemic, and it wasn't just one disease. It was a whole basket full of European diseases to which people had no immunity. So, and I remember, of course, I'm not quite that old, but my mother went through the 1919 Spanish flu epidemic.
Killed
millions. Yeah. And I've followed with great interest the Ebola Marburg stories. So it is true that more people have been killed by epidemic diseases than have ever been killed in wars.
How far in you don't have any time reference. I mean, in what year you think this is taking place?
Yeah, I know. It's always a bit dangerous, isn't it, to put in a time reference.
Yeah, I guess so.
1984. Well, we've been there. Didn't happen.
Didn't happen. But you think this
2001, a space odyssey. Didn't happen.
Didn't happen. Yeah. A lot of things didn't happen. But you really do. I get from reading the book, you really think this is, and now it's even a more greater possibility.
Well,
given modern technology.
Okay. A caveat. I don't think anybody can really predict the future. Why? Because there isn't the future. It is an infinite series of possibilities with a lot of wild cards that we don't know anything about. So Rumsfeld was right about one thing. It's the unknown unknowns that get you. And there are unknown unknowns. You know, you can't really predict, quotes, the future. You can make any book about the future is anyway about the present, is it not? Because the future is like death. We've We've never been there and come back, much though we love to write fantasies about time travel. We've never actually done it.
Your dystopia is a biological dystopia. People are dying.
Well, it's not, it's only bad news for people.
Fair.
Everything else does better.
Yeah, I've heard that from other biologists who say, the Earth doesn't need us to survive.
There you go. But there's your biologists for you.
Cockroaches will be here forever.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if all the ants died, we'd be in big trouble.
Yes. What about artificial intelligence? Is that the next dystopia? You hear people talking about that they're going to be smarter than we are. The robots are going to take over. There's going to be a point where we can't control them anymore. What's your take on that?
We've been writing this fantasy for a long time. In fact, I did a presentation to a robotics conference. I don't know why. Why do people ask me to do these things?
You're too nice.
I don't know. Yes. So the first artificial intelligence in human form is in the Iliad. This is a dream that goes way, way back. It's the god Hephaestus who's got some helpers that he has made. They're in the form of, I wonder why it's always like this, they're good-looking girls made of gold.
Right.
It's in the Iliad.
Right.
Okay, then we move on through time. We've got the Pygmalion story. He makes an artificial woman. He falls in love with her. Venus takes pity on him, and she comes to life, and that gives you the musical My Fair Lady. And then Coppelia, the ballet, artificial doll, it's in Tales of Hoffman, and on through Metropolis, the film, and Carl Čapek's novel called RUR, which is where we first hear the word robot.
Right.
Okay, and then on through one of my favorites, The Stepford Wives. Mm. Love it.
Boy, that gives me chills just remembering that.
Blade Runner. So these things have been going.
iRobot,
exactly. I like that one too. And John Wyndham's short story called The Compassion Circuit. Remember that?
I don't know.
Okay, it's a domestic robot that is in doubt. Anybody know? The Compassion Circuit, short story, John Wyndham. It's a robot who is endowed with a compassion circuit and is suited for domestic use. And they have one in a household in which the wife is quite ill and is suffering a lot. And the husband comes home one day, and there's the wife's head picking it from under the cover, saying, "I'm not in pain anymore, dear." And the robot has, because it felt so sorry for her, it's cut off her head and attached it to a robotic body.
Wow.
So she's not in pain anymore.
Right. Even Rod Serling had a lot of robots on the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, as
rebellion.
One would,
they were rebelled. I remember there was one scene where there were more like wearables that were rebelling. There was one where somebody came home and the vacuum cleaner was coming down the steps to attack them, and in the bathroom the electric shaver started rearing up like a snake and things like that.
Yeah, remember the Walt Disney film? The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yes.
It was in Fantasia.
Right.
So animated objects. It used to be called magic. You animated inanimate things. But now that we have robotics, I suppose
Are you worried about the robotics becoming?
Am I worried?
This dystopia? Do you think? Yeah. I mean,
I'm not worried about that. No, I'm actually not very worried about it at all. I love my little Roomba. I want to put eyes and a tail on it. It's so cute.
why do you think that your dystopia novel don't have any Walking Dead in them? You said you're not a science. Is that science fiction? The Walking Dead is too much science fiction, but it's such a meme
now. The Walking Dead is not science fiction or a speculative fiction. It's horror. It's horror fantasy. So we are not yet working on, or maybe we are. I do not think we're yet working on ways of animating dead, falling apart, smelly dead bodies. Are we?
Are we?
Yeah.
I'm asking the people listening to our conversation.
Yeah, we're working on immortality. There are a lot of people interested in that, and there are a lot of, oh, the latest one, of course, is the blood experiments, in which, you can rejuvenate old mice by putting the blood of young mice into them. Guard your babies. That's all I have to say.
I have to think about that one.
Yeah, well, people are already thinking about it. And I just read, I forget the name of the guy, but somebody with quite a lot of money has just invested in the company that's thinking about it. Where are they going to get this rejuvenating blood, I ask you?
Well,
not from me.
I'm safe. Not have any choice.
I'm safe. So are you.
Well, we may not have any, you know.
We have, our blood isn't very young. Shh, don't tell.
Goes back to it
could be.
Well, you know, there was all this research about taking blood out of young animals, putting it into older animals, that would rejuvenate.
That's what I told you. Yeah.
And it's about people, they used to do that with transfusions.
But they were not for the purpose of regenerating them, it was for the purpose of keeping them alive, which is a somewhat different idea. In fact, they're probably taking rotten old blood from just anybody and sticking it in. This has to be a certain kind of blood.
What kind?
Young.
Young blood.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a name there. Let's talk
You're thinking about this a little too seriously.
No. When it comes down to blood, you know.
Yeah, well, everything's in Sherlock Holmes. So there's a story in Sherlock Holmes in which a guy is getting baboon injections in order to become younger. Unfortunately, it gives him the habit of clambering up the walls.
What a baboon does?
And it doesn't, actually. I think he got his animals mixed up.
So that he made that up.
Needed
something.
He didn't really go into the baboons, but the idea is there. Is it not?
Well, let's talk. Let's move on to something a little different. Let's talk about your world that you create in Oryx and Crake and the absence of art.
Yeah, well, Crake has a dim view of art.
What? Fill me in on that.
Well, Crake feels that symbolic thinking, which is what we preeminently do, is at the root of a lot of evils. So he tries to make his new creatures, whom we know as Krakers, he tries to make them without symbolic thinking. As we learn, he does not succeed. But he feels that symbolic thinking gives rise to things that he doesn't approve of, such as kings and religions and social classes and art, those things.
He says, it's just for the artist. It serves a biological purpose. And as if biological, I think he means here, reproduction.
He's a bit reductionist, is he not?
And this line I particularly liked in this age. And female artists are biologically confused.
You hear those kinds of things.
Tell me what you meant by that.
Well, I'll tell you what Craig meant
by it.
Okay. So the reason that male artists make art, in his view, is to attract females. And so female artists, therefore, are biologically confused because of their art, of course, would not perform that function, in his view. Mm-hmm. I think he is the example of the frog who finds a drain pipe and makes it croak louder. So he thinks of art as the drain pipe that allows the croak of the male person to become louder. It acts like a megaphone for that person. He must have been thinking about Picasso.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Somebody like that.
Picasso. I got also the impression that he thinks that art is done just to show off.
That's what he thinks.
Yeah, artists just do that to show off. That's their main
purpose.
That's
what he thinks, but he's not an artist. He doesn't know that they might have other more noble motives, does he?
I guess he doesn't.
No. What do you think?
I think he's your image of him as a scientist is a great reductionist. He is a reductionist who is just cares about, you know, getting the job done. And
well, he also cares about bothering his friend Jimmy. You have to realize that this is an interaction between the two of them in which he has always had one up. So because Jimmy's interested in art and words and things, Craig has to put them down.
And the scene near the end where there's the death scene in the little cubicle.
Whenever. Oh, I hope you're not giving things away.
Well, they've all said they... I didn't say who died.
Okay.
Is that just to create an isolation of Jimmy by himself?
You mean why is Jimmy left by himself?
Yeah.
Because Craig knows that he himself is not really capable as a person of being the good shepherd of his creatures, whereas he thinks that Jimmy, with his sense of ethics, however tiny, and his good heart, however warped, will actually take care of these people, which he does.
And the name Snowman.
Love it.
I think I got a hint of where it comes from, but I wasn't sure.
Well, there are two places that it comes from. One is the abominable snowman, a mythological creature who may or may not exist, which is how Jimmy is thinking of himself by that time. And the other is the traditional snowman that is melting away.
Yet even through all this apocalypse, there is a glimmer of hope in this work.
Would it be a novel without a glimmer of hope?
You know, you're right.
I mean, it would have been very cavalier just to have killed everybody off on page 175.
Well, is that the definition that separates Craig from everyone else?
I think it's the definition that separates novels from real life. Because novels are always the story of a person or people, and it's very rare to have the ending of a novel in which everybody is dead. In fact, I can't think of one. Even Moby Dick, which kills off everybody, there's one remaining.
Right. Okay, thank you. Well, I'll go on, but I know we'll have to allow some time for the audience to participate. So you've heard our thoughts on Oryx and Craig, and now we want to hear yours if you have a question. We have a microphone.
Hi, I'm Jan. I'm from New York. I was wondering if you ever considered elaborating more on Oryx in the novels, aside from the little bit of history that you do give on her background?
We could write another whole book about Oryx, but I'm not going to. I think people have said to me things like, why doesn't she talk about her past? Why doesn't she do this? Why doesn't she do that? People who have had that kind of trauma often don't. They don't want to revisit it. They've done it once, that was enough. And there is also a sort of victim porn that goes on in which other people want to hear about it. But Oryx is not going to come across.
No voyeurism.
No, she's not going to she's not going to cater to the voyeurism.
Okay, next question. Please step up.
Hi, I'm Kristen and I live in Brooklyn. I actually work in biotechnology and I attended a conference a few years ago called SynBioBeta in San Francisco, where it was the first, the inaugural synthetic biology conference. So I've been in synthetic biology for a few years.
It must have been pretty fascinating.
It was incredible. But there was a moment where Craig Venter was talking about growing kidneys in pigs, and I texted my friend, "Oh my God, Pagoons are real." And then, recently he was back in the news for talking about, one of the fathers of the Human Genome Project, sequencing the human genome. He was recently back in the news talking about synthesizing an entire human genome from scratch. And I was curious about, whether you'd heard about that, what your thoughts are about it, and whether you think that we are responsible enough as a society and as scientists to wield that kind of power in synthetic biology at this point.
Are we responsible enough? No. is that going to stop us? No. I was at a conference, I think last year, called Beings, and they brought together a bunch of ethicists and a bunch of biologists to discuss these very kinds of projects. And some people were saying, we shouldn't do this, we shouldn't do that, this and that should be forbidden. And I was just thinking, this is Pandora's box. It's already open. So anytime you give human beings a new toy, they play with it. And they often play with it very creatively, and sometimes with unintended consequences. So people also say to me, well, what do you think about gene splicing and blah, 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 blah. And I say, it's case by case. You know, you introduce white mustard into North America, it has no predators, it explodes, it's an invasive species. And any newly created species is going to be the same. It's going to be case by case. So what is it? What's it used for? What are its capabilities, negative and positive? Should we have giant salmon? You know, and all of these questions are going to come up. Yeah. And it's no good saying, thou shalt not do any such thing, because people are going to do that thing. You then have to make decisions case by case. And the reason I'm against genetically modified crops is not the thing itself, the thing that you eat. I'm not against that. I'm against the method used to produce them, which are soil-killing methods and very destructive to the ecosystem, and also destroy a big carbon-sequestering system. Those are my reasons for being against that. But I'm not against raccoons. Those would be really cute.
All right, next up, have your name and where you're from, please.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Jesse from Brooklyn. And I was just wondering, so at the end, when Jimmy returns to the Krakers, they sort of have this cult following towards him. So in that sense, as the Krakers expand and become, you know, they grow and become more territorial.
So in other words, they get symbolic thinking.
Yeah. In that sense, is war unavoidable in human nature?
Is war unavoidable in human nature? Woo. I think conflict of one kind or another, it would be pretty hard to find a society that doesn't have any conflict. If by war we mean organized armies and stuff like that, you can't have those unless you have a food surplus. You can have skirmishes, you can have violent episodes, but you're not going to get an organized army going march, 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 toot, 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 unless you can support, unless the rest of the society can feed that army.
Okay.
So John Keegan, The History of Warfare, that's your best book on that subject.
A twofer tonight. Your name and where you're from.
Hi, I'm Caitlin. I'm from Queens. My little sister actually just started medical school at the University of Chicago, so this is a question she wanted me to ask you. She actually wrote about one of your poems for her admissions essay, so thanks for helping her get to med school. But I figured she'd have an intelligent question, but this is what she came up with, so get ready. She wants to know, how quickly into a Trump presidency can we expect paintball arenas to be constructed?
How quickly into a Trump presidency can we expect
paintball arenas to be constructed?
Paintball arenas to be constructed.
Yes.
About 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Who knows? I mean, this is a part of the future. This is one of the future possible. You're betting on it.
Are you
actually putting money on it?
Well, I got to cover both ways.
You do? Now. Okay, right.
Yes.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay. I'm Rachel from Brooklyn, and this is a question about readership and audience. When I am looking around this room, my visual survey is that it's maybe 3 or 4 women to 1 man. And
they're here to meet chicks. Oh, sorry, that was a bad joke. I didn't mean
No, it's cheap date night here. It's cheap date night.
Can I say I'm here to meet people?
Yes, you can. Yes.
And I think of that as a departure from my notion of the composition of readership of...
It is a departure. So here's my analysis. Men read books. They read books a lot. They even read my books. But they are less likely to turn out to public events, and they are much less likely to stand in line to get their book signed. Why is that? Because they don't like to stand in line for anything. So there are quite a few of them, for instance, on things like Twitter accounts and so forth. But they're less... I think for women coming to an event like this, it's more like a social event that has a social element to it. And even standing in line has a social element. So they will talk to the other people in the line, and they'll talk about books, and they'll talk about other things they've read, etc. So it's that element that may not happen so much. Am I right?
Well, I was wondering, I'm thinking about putting the last two questions together. Does that mean that men would not stand in a long line to vote?
They don't like standing in the line. But if
I'm
it
just
means...
thinking about the upcoming election. If the lines are very long, would men drop out of the line?
I don't know. You could do a survey.
There's a lot of men in the line, and more than women.
Yeah, but they're going to feel more passionately about getting their word in, because voting is the thing where they get to say something, right? Whereas just getting your book signed, yeah.
Well, we'll find out. Yes, next, please.
Hi, Jan Castro. Thank you, Margaret.
Where are you
You're
from?
Wonderful. I'm from Brooklyn.
Everybody's from Brooklyn.
And so my question is a little weird. Today on NPR, there was something on testosterone depletion, and I was wondering if the Soma pills had anything to do with things that are now on the market, like Viagra and...
Wow. You mean the ones that he's handing out, Bliss Plus?
Yes.
Yeah, Soma is in Brave New World.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, obviously, they're hormone influencing. But are you wondering where I got that idea?
Yeah, I'm wondering where your research came from.
Yeah, those things were around. I mean, Viagra's pretty old by now. And they even had developed a sort of, quotes, female Viagra, which I understand didn't work that well. Is this right?
Okay. You're asking me.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't followed it very closely, but you probably have science reporter.
I've always heard it said that, why was birth control made for women and not men originally?
Is that what was said? Well,
is that right? I'll ask you. Is that right?
Why was it made for women and not men?
Why did men design birth control, but mostly for women and not for men?
Well, probably because it's the woman who has the larger biological investment in having a baby. So, therefore, it is she who should decide where and when she's going to make that investment.
That would be the biological answer, not the political answer.
Oh, the political answer is probably joined at the hip with the biological answer in some way that I haven't really thought about very deeply. But I'm sure that that is so. Mm-hmm. I will leave that to you. You're the younger generation.
Thank you. You're very kind. yes.
Hi, I'm Claudia. I'm from Brooklyn. So when I was reading Oryx and Crake, I was really intrigued by your conception of life bloggers, especially with Anna Kay, and also sort of the celebrity achieved by people on Nighty Night or in Paintball. And I was wondering, what are your feelings on people who become celebrities through things like YouTube or Instagram, who are really only in the light for a very short time?
Well, a lot of pop stars have only been in the light for a very short time. Andy Warhol was in some way right. In the future, everybody will be famous for 30 minutes. So that's their 30 15, minutes.
15?
Oh,
so
15.
You already lost half
all
that
right,
time.
Already, it's already gone.
Yeah.
They're motivated to be, those people are motivated to at least be individuals and noticed. Coming from the, as a, being a child in the early 40s, people sent their kids to tap dancing school because they wanted them to be like Shirley Temple. You know, each age has its own model of what being famous means. And we've invented a new set of platforms, and to use a biological model, life expands to fit all niches available. And it's expanded into YouTube.
Well,
some pretty weird ways.
I can't top that with another question. There's really, speaking of fame, no one more famous in the literary world than Margaret Atwood, and I want to thank you all. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you,
Margaret, for joining us tonight. I want to thank the Housing Works. Let's hear it for the Housing Works people. If you have a few extra minutes, Margaret's going to be out there signing books that you've purchased here, so stick around and say hi and get her John Hancock on your copy. And thank you, everybody, again, for coming on out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.